Talk given Saturday, 25th of January, 1975.
It has been customary for people through the ages to ask how far and in which way living the religious life affects our everyday life. From the record of history of centuries and centuries, we have seen practically no difference in the world of affairs, politically, economically, and so on, which may be ascribed to people living the religious life as such. And therefore, people have separated religion from the rest of life. They say we live in the world and we have problems. And those problems are pressing and urgent because our very life and our existence is involved with them. Whereas religion is a thing for the few, they say. Those who can retire or afford to retire from the affairs of the world and give themselves up to a life of contemplation and so forth. And so there is always this inquiry, does the living of the religious life better our condition in the world? And in our own day and age, right now, people have become extremely skeptical about the value, a utilitarian value, mind you, of religion. Now, this skepticism is due to the fact that people have not the capacity or sometimes the intention to look deeply enough into the problem. They fail to see that the condition of the world externally is a reflection of our own condition within ourselves internally, of each and every one of us individually. Every one of us in the world is responsible for the world condition, the external world condition. Even a little examination, a somewhat careful scrutiny, nevertheless, will show that all our institutions, all our procedures in the world of affairs, whilst on the one hand they are influenced by factors outside humanity, such as the climate and the geography, the natural resources and so forth, are fundamentally influenced by our own desires, our ambitions, our pursuits, our indispensable needs like food and shelter and warmth and so forth. And of these factors, the external, namely the land and so forth, and ourselves, our desires and ambitions and all the rest of it, of these factors, the land we can't control. We can't alter the shape of the British Isles or of any of the continents. They are what they are. They are situated where they are. They have the natural resources which they do have. We can't do anything about that apart from what is commonly and not not wrongly called exploiting the resources of the land, you see, but ourselves. That is the factor that we can really change. We can change ourselves. Why do we have, especially in our world today, these terrible problems of frustration and violence? Those are the two outstanding features of the world. Is it because of external conditions? Or is it because I, the person, am a violent person, and my violence inevitably expresses itself in my daily life? Now, this is a very serious matter, because it shows us that each one of us individually is responsible, in fact, but also in fact, we all shirk our responsibility. We always point to the other person and his fault, and we always try to excuse ourselves. We always point to the other nation, the other firm or company or government or whatever it is that does this, that, and the other, and therefore our ills descend upon us. Who is this other person whom I am blaming? Myself. This is something we are entirely ignorant of. Who are you but another version of myself? Who am I but another version of you? Fundamentally, all humans, the entire species, consists of members who are very largely similar. And only slightly are we different. It is true that the difference may range from idiocy at one end right up to genius at the other. From utter depravity and evil-naturedness to the supreme peaks of sainship and perfection. It is true that the difference may be as much as that. But let us not be deceived by the difference which we observe and which strikes our attention so forcibly. In between those, both the saint and the sinner have a lot which is in common. You are another version of myself. I am another version of yourselves. So now, it's no good blaming the other person. That is folly. I can't compel the other person to do right, to do good. Nor can I compel myself to do right and to do good. Because compulsion, whether exercised upon the other or whether exercised upon myself, inevitably brings into being, ultimately, a reaction against the compulsion. And that reaction against the compulsion is an act of hate, an act of violence, because one is fighting against something else. If I don't fight, I do something else. I run away. That is, I try to run away. But this again is only expressive of my own folly. Where shall I run away? Can I get out of the world? Yes, when you all come with sad expressions on your faces and lay flowers on 5 feet 6 inches or 6.5 inches, as the case may be, of good English earth or whatever it may be. That is the only way I can really make good my escape. Otherwise, definitely not. So, one can neither escape nor fight without introducing complication, violence, and greater difficulty. That is, what can we do then, you will ask? Now, this precisely is where religion comes in. We can understand ourselves, and in understanding ourselves, grow into true manhood. We are subhuman. We are not humans yet. We are, just at present anyway, in a wildly adolescent state. Hence this terrible upheaval and violence, this utter stupidity, this conflict of opposing greeds and passions, all this is the extremely sick adolescent humanity, subhuman to a terrible extent. It is bestial. Its natural animality, which, if allowed proper sway, would keep it in harmony with nature's laws, has been lost temporarily, of course. So now, this question which arises, what use is religion? The real answer is, it is the only thing that is of use and value. The religious life is the only life which is the solution to the problems of the world by bringing about a resolution of the whole situation, first within ourselves and then in the outer world, by undergoing this transformation in our own consciousness and in our own nature. Always bear in mind that any true healing can take place only from a transcendent level. No human problem, no circumstantial difficulty can ever be really solved at its own level. Healing comes from something profounder, something which acts as an integrative power, and not as a force which gets rid of, or tries to get rid of, or destroy that which is painful, hurtful, evil, undesirable, and so on. Because every attempt to destroy, in the senseless meaning of the term destroy, brings about its own reaction. When we think we are destroying something which is evil, we are only breaking it up and allowing it to reform without our knowing it. Look what has happened in the lifetime of some of us anyway. Some of you are too young to know it. But in our own lifetime, we who have seen two wars and looked at the so-called treaties of peace which have been drawn up, looked at the so-called unconditional surrender of the defeated and what has happened with them and through them and in relation to us, we who have seen all this, if we can really see with open eyes, we will see that we only reform that which we break up. And if it is broken up to a degree where the people who are broken up cannot reform, then our greeds and our self-interest and vested interests make us help the defeated to come up again. And they do it rather better than we can manage our own affairs after having been conquerors of the world. Alexander the Great was a world conqueror, as he thought. He died at the age of 33. And what happened to his vast empire? The moment he died, within a very short time, it split up into separate groups. Fissiparous tendencies immediately come into play. And as a result, that which was supposed to be compelled into being one great united whole is split up into more parts than it ever was before. That is no way at all. How does religion approach it? As I have already said, by understanding ourselves, first and foremost, self-knowledge. You remember the famous saying, "Nothi se auton," know thyself, which was carved over the entrance to the famous Academy of Plato and the Platonic school. Nothi se auton, man, know thyself. And that statement is derived from the old Rig Vedic and Upanishadic Atmanam Atmana Pasya. Pasya, to see in the sense of understand, know. Atmanam, the Atma, your essential being, Atmana, by means of this essential being. Now that's very interesting. Atmanam, the accusative case there, the self, Atmana, instrumental, by means of the self, pasya, to see, to know. Now you consider this, and you will see that there is a difference between this and the Greek statement, nothi se auton, know thyself. If we ask any average intelligent person in the civilized world, how does he come to know himself? He says, oh, well, I suppose if I watch what I am doing and observe my actions and my characteristics and so forth, I will know myself. Will he? Thousands, millions of people have been doing that through the centuries. Has the human race, have the members of the human race come to know themselves that way? They know the outward phenomena. They are passing thoughts and feelings, their desires, their ambitions, their reactions, their hatreds, their greeds, and all the rest of it. All these are the passing phenomena. And they think they know themselves. And to add to the difficulty, they regard themselves as something fixed, unchangeable. This is me, is it? What is this wonderful me? It's less of a reality than this carpet or that piano or the walls. It's a perpetually changing something, a will-o'-the-wisp. So you see, even the so-called intelligent person has quite a mistaken idea of what self-knowledge means. Then you go to the orthodox philosophical religious man. Ah, it's all in the books. It's stated that you are a spark of the eternal, the immortal God, and this and that and the other and so forth. And the whole thing is beautifully clear-cut intellectually and set out as a system of mental constructs. This is the path, this is the way, that's how you know yourself. Well, of course, you can condition the mind to believe anything whatsoever. You can so condition yourself that you will actually see phenomena taking place which are not taking place there. Because it's one of the easiest things in the world to produce a sufficiently powerful impression on the mind to make you believe that you actually saw, you actually heard, you actually touched or tasted or experienced this, that and the other. But you don't. These are impressions. They have no correspondence with reality as such. What then is the meaning, the significance of Atmanam Atmana Pasya? What is this mysterious thing they call the Atma? The ultimate reality, as your philosopher would say, or the absolute. Or, to use Buddhistic terms, this mysterious unborn, unbecome, unmade, this something which is the end of all ill, call it nirvana if you like, or the kingdom of heaven if you like, call it God if you like. What is this mysterious something? And then we see that we don't know this ultimate reality at all. This absolute is something quite unknown. And if you go deeper into it, you find that it is unknowable. But it is totally experienceable. Do you know what it is to experience that which you cannot know? We have all experienced it in some way or other. Have we not known just that magical flash of love for parent or child, brother or sister, for friend, for the stranger? But can you tell me what love is? You'll be a greater genius than the world's supreme geniuses if you can tell me, can define love. It is the unknown, the unknowable in its reality. And yet you and I have experienced it. So you see, those who said Atmanam Atmana Pasya well understood that it is transcendence itself, the unknown, the unknowable, but the absolute reality, which functions through us in such a way that we here, as individual beings, psychophysical beings, can grow to understand ourselves. Now, I'm using the word understanding, admittedly, in an arbitrary way. The common dictionary meaning, of course, ties up understanding with knowledge, with intellect, perception, and all the rest of it. I'm using it in quite a different way. Then you observe through your senses without letting the conditioning of the mind influence what you see or hear or touch through your various senses. Then you are aware of a thing or a person or an event in quite a different way from the way in which you are aware ordinarily. Ordinarily I say, oh, I see that oak tree. Or I say, oh, there's John Smith, I know him. You see, I saw John Smith. I did not see John Smith. I did not see that tree. What I actually saw was my particular mental construct of the tree. I love oak trees, or I detest such and such trees, don't like them. So whenever I see that tree, I look with hate. And whenever I see the other tree, I look with craving, with attachment. Do I see the truth of the thing? No. Now you see, all our senses function in this diseased way. But when our senses do not function in the diseased way, then we become aware of the truth of things as they are. And you will find it extremely difficult to give a verbal description then of what you see or hear or touch. Because the meanings, the dictionary meanings of all our words are conditioned meanings. When you read the word, a construct is made by your mind, in your own mind. Partly it will have correspondence with the reality, but very largely it will not have correspondence with the reality, especially when you are dealing with other living beings. But if and when I can be quiet and silent inside my own mind, let that clamor cease, and then use my senses, I am no longer gathering knowledge, but I am growing in wisdom. Now this is a knowing which is of quite a different nature from knowing as the world has experienced through the centuries and believes is the nature of knowing. And side by side with that, another thing happens. When I look or listen with all my own conditioning, all my own desires and reactions to what I'm seeing or hearing, when all those reactions are absent, there is an extraordinary experiencing of the reality of love. And the only way I can express it in, suggest it in words is this. That when I see that way, when I listen that way, the otherness of that which I see or hear is out. It is me, myself. When I see you, it is myself I am seeing. When it is a rose or the sky, or if you like, a heap of dung, it is me, myself, that I see. And you see, once this separation between that and me is out, then what is there to hate? There is nothing left to hate. It takes two to hate. It takes two to make love, which is not love. You cannot make that which is the eternal reality. It's a strange conceit. And see into what misery and sorrow this making love has led man into. He doesn't know love. So, when you get this experiencing, this living, through the use of the senses, in such a manner that love and wisdom have actually come into being, the mystery, then there is understanding. It is in that way that I use the word understanding. Now I ask you, supposing we understood ourselves that way, what is one of its great implications? There is no self-hate possible. You can't hate that which you have truly understood. It's impossible. You cannot react against, because there is no other to be against. It is just yourself. Can I be against my own nose or ear, or the few hairs that I have left on my head? They're at the back, you can't see them. You see, it's impossible to be against. That is me. What is there to be against? So you see, self-hate is out of the situation. And if self-hate is out of the situation, self-condemnation as well as self-praise is out of the situation. Because I can only praise in myself that which I see as something other than my usual self. So I have conceit and pride. You see what a tremendous amount is involved in these things. It's absolutely terrific. So self-hate and self-praise are out. In short, the whole of selfness is out of the situation. Now, is it In such a situation, can one be violent anywhere? Can one contribute to the violence of the world? Even more, can one be swept aside by the violence of the world? What I mean by that is this. You know how mass hysteria spreads. A person who in himself is a very nice person, you have known him the last 60 years, a quiet, gentle, friendly person, and he gets caught up in a mob hysteria and is swept into wrong action with the mad crowd. That's what I mean. You see? So one is not then swept aside by the violence of the world, by the evil of the world. One sees the evil as the evil, the violence as the violence, for exactly what it is. But this inner poise, this equanimity, which is born of being love and wisdom in harmony, and having understanding therefore, keeps you completely whole and untouched inwardly by the violence of the world. What then would be one's influence upon the world if one is like that? First and foremost, you will realize that it is a mistake to rush into the affairs of the world, join societies for promoting this welfare and that good and all the rest of it, you see, in order to set the world right. You can't do it. Keep yourself right. Just be yourself. By means of the transcendent, you have seen the transcendent. Atmanam atmana pasya. You have understood yourself. And as a result, this transcendent reality, the total reality, can function through you as an individual if you don't interfere with the transcendent power and reality. It knows. I don't know. And therefore, you will influence the world in the rightest possible way. It's extremely hard to remain aware of this 24 hours each day. But this is one of the deep meanings of yoga. Yoga. The rejoining, the restoring of the cut-off separate bit, self, to the total reality. This is yoga. And when you are in complete and perfect relationship with the total reality, your influence is unbounded. It's unlimited. You will never see it. If you try to see it, you'll spoil it all. You must never try to see what the results are. Because we all measure results by finite standards, which must of necessity fail in very many more circumstances than the circumstances in which they could apply. Because the reality is the infinite, not the finite. So I'm a fool if I try to look at the results and measure what good has been done. I'm perfectly content with the fact that I can spell the word good in the English language. And that's quite good enough. Leave the rest to transcendence itself. As the theists would put it, unto God the glory. Remember Sri Krishna's teaching? Perform thou action as unto me. Thy business is with the action, not with the results. What did the Buddha teach? Right conduct of body, of speech, and of mind. Right conduct. Now, what is not sufficiently expounded in the texts is, what do you mean by right conduct? People want a measure of right conduct. Now, there is no measure of right conduct. That is why it is not much expounded. No attempt is made to expound. It's taken for granted that you know what it means to abstain from harming. You know the meaning of harming. All right. But the extent to which I know the meaning of harming is very, very small. I know that if I hit a fellow on the head hard, I'm harming him. I know that if I'm deliberately saying things which is not a true description of the fact, I am lying. But these are just the first kindergarten stages. This is all very superficial. go deeply enough into harming, say. If I look at a person with impatience because he jumped the queue and went into the bus before I did, am I harming him? Certainly myself. I am harming myself, giving way to impatience. Look at the innumerable ways in which we harm ourselves and the environment. So you see, the simple rules of right conduct, to abstain from harming, not to take what is not freely given unto you. You see, to indulge the senses, driven by pleasure lust. To speak that which is not true, that which is malicious, slanderous, gossipy, idle, vain, stupid, unnecessary. All these things are specifically mentioned. How often do we speak just what is essential, what is truly helpful, what is truly constructive, what is the truth itself, that is to say, insofar as the word can express the reality? How often do we do that? One need not only listen to the chatter which goes on in a bus or at a dinner party or whatever it is. Listen to the chatter here, day in and day out, inside one's own head. So you see, right conduct of body, speech, and the mind. Here is your basis. And here also, remember, is the goal, the end point. When you have realized sainthood, and to be a man begins at that stage, realized saintship is the beginning of manhood, of the truly spiritual life, which is possible only to man. When you have realized saintship, you will abstain from harming, not take what is not freely given, etc., etc., naturally and easily, at your ease, unconsciously, inevitably. At the beginning, we have to keep mindful about it. And when the mindfulness has flowered into absolute perfection, all these lovely things which distinguish man will have happened by themselves, will happen by themselves quite naturally. Now, under such kind of circumstances, what sort of a world will there be externally? What will be our influence in the world? Therefore, how will we draw up agreements with the man who is doing business with us? How will we deal with the pupil in the class, with the teacher who is teaching me, with everybody around me? How will I deal with the so-called inanimate objects of the world? How do I deal with them today? As a shameless, a very senseless exploiter. We have exploited the world so terribly that it has given birth to this new science and knowledge of ecology at last. We are going to destroy ourselves if we exploit the world very much more. So you see, the living of the religious life, introduces into our own individual being the reality and the power of transcendence itself, and it effects the necessary transformation and brings things to a state of harmony. Now do not think for a moment a state of harmony is one in which there is no tension. What is the meaning of real harmony, real health? It means the balance of opposing tensions. Otherwise, harmony is like a static block. You won't be happy with a static block for very long, believe me. The movement of life is one in which there are tensions. Tensions in the sense not of strain and stress, but in the sense of healthy muscle tone. Healthy tone of body, healthy tone of mind and heart. And harmony is the balance of opposing tensions. Opposing not as irreconcilable enemies, but as partners playing a game. Do you think that the world polity, the world economy, the social relationships and all the rest of it which exist today will any longer exist if you and I were like that? Is there anything which is more practical than religion? I'll put it the other way and say, is there anything at all which is practical apart from religion? Is it not the only practical thing? And religion means the purification of myself and the awakening from within, the enlightening by means of which I am perpetually, consciously in communion with the total reality.